Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website, kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington, so very special. Our Town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, from bus drivers to baristas, and even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We were all hunkered down hiding from the virus during the years 2000 and 2021. Only in 2022 did people begin to venture out, and honestly, it really wasn't until this year, 2023, most people began to feel comfortable enough to attend mass events, such as concerts or lectures. I remember the not-so-good old day when virtually all of our town shows were done totally on Zoom. Most cultural events were badly hurt by the pandemic. A couple of weeks ago, I had Rob Berman, head of Centrum, talking about this season. Well, as everyone knows who attended some of the concerts, Centrum concerts this summer, it seems to be a resounding success. My guest today is Danielle McClelland, the executive director of the Port Townsend Film Festival. She, too, has an upbeat story. The film festival is emerging from its pandemic cocoon like a beautiful butterfly. So welcome to the show, Danny.
Thank you so much, Marianne. It's great to be here.
I always like to begin back at the beginning. Are you a local girl born and bred in Jefferson County?
I am not, unfortunately. It would have been wonderful to grow up here. I actually was born and raised until I was 13 in Kansas. But when I was 13, my family moved to Bellevue, Washington. And then my parents retired to Port Townsend in 1997. Okay. And so Port Townsend has been home base for me since that time.
Okay, let's hop back to Kansas, Dorothy. Let's do it for a minute. What did your folks do?
So my mom was a nurse and my dad was an electrician for a DuPont plastics plant.
Okay. And do you have any siblings?
I do have an older brother, Darren, who lives in Quilcene now.
Well, that's close. Mm-hmm. So were you raised in the kind of household where it was expected that you would go on to university?
Not so much. I mean, I think that there was definitely the idea that was a very real possibility. But both my mother and father did not do traditional college. My mom did nursing school, and my dad went for part of a year, twice, maybe three times over the course of his early 20s, but continued in a trade.
Now, some kids have a real clear desire by the time they're in high school or towards the end of high school of what they want to be when they grew up. Were you one of those kids?
In high school, my dream was to become an international lawyer on the world court with the idea that I was going to personally end nuclear proliferation.
Okay, that's a good goal, really. Okay, and so where did you end up going to school?
So I went to college at Lewis and Clark in Portland.
Uh-huh.
And started out there in the political science, international relations degree, but very quickly was called like more and more deeply, more and more strongly to enter the theater department. So I ended up with a degree in English and creative writing, or with English and theater with creative writing as a focus in both areas.
Okay, so the world court will have to wait.
Yes, maybe in retirement I'll get my law degree.
Okay, so while you were studying, most young people have jobs in the summer and maybe part-time during school. Did you do any sort of jobs while you were in that phase of your life?
I did. I started out working at a small sandwich shop that quickly grew into a cooking position. And I did that at the very beginning of, you know, like early on in high school, as soon as I was old enough to work, and continued doing professional cooking for 12 years as my day job while I pursued theater, you know, while I was getting my college degree, and then while I pursued theater and writing in different types. Cooking was always my day job.
Okay, well, paid the bills. I presume it was something
it
you liked.
It sure did. And I really, really enjoy both the culture of a kitchen and working with chefs who ultimately have so much more creativity about food than I do. But I really enjoyed the physical movement and the fire and the knives and the drama that is working a rush on a line in a very busy professional kitchen.
Okay. And why did you end up leaving that? What happened?
Why did I end up leaving cooking?
Yes.
Well, I chopped a good portion of the top of my finger off during one shift when my partner and I were living in Austin, Texas. And of course, like so many restaurant workers, we had no health insurance. You know, we were just squeaking by. And that whole experience really influenced the way both my partner and I thought about what I should be, you know, like how my focus, where my focus should be and what kind of minimum requirements I had for a job. And okay. So I actually left cooking when we moved to Bloomington, Indiana.
Now, wait a minute. So you were in Portland and then you were in Austin, Texas. Was there anywhere else along the way?
Yes, we actually, I met my partner, Susan Ferrantinos, in Portland when we were still in our early 20s. And we left there to go on a grand adventure. We were going to travel around the country for as long as we could afford to do it and not settle down. It was maybe a proto van life choice
adventure
that we made, yes, before van life existed. And we ended up just traveling all over, visiting friends. And along the way, we found that we could easily find a place to camp and some food and friendship by offering ourselves up as field hands on organic farms and using the farmers markets and the co-ops in different cities to get connected to that network of people. And we would camp on the land at, you know, some organic farm for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and help in the fields and have time to do other stuff and meet some new people. And then when we were ready to move on, then we'd go to the next town and do the same thing.
At some point, you were in New Orleans, right?
That's correct. Immediately after I finished college, before I met Sue, I left Portland, Oregon, to live in New Orleans, originally with the idea I was going to cook down there, but that never happened.
Okay. Seems like an interesting place to be.
New Orleans is fantastic. It's still one of my favorite places.
Okay, so you and Susan did this van life for a while. Mm-hmm. Where did you decide to perch when?
Well, we ran out of money in Colorado.
What happens?
And we had the choice of coming back up to Seattle to stay with my folks or to camp out in Austin, Texas with a cousin of mine. Those were the two closest places we could get to and have some support. So we decided Texas was the way to go, and we ended up staying there 2 years.
And were you still cooking at that point?
And I was. I actually worked for a wonderful, well, maybe wonderful is not exactly the right word, but it was a fantastic experience, a very rich experience. I was the kitchen manager for a restaurant in Austin, Texas called Spaghetti Western that was a Tex-Mex Italian place.
Nice combo.
Yes. So I always think it was a precursor to the rest of my life that I worked for a restaurant that was about a movie genre.
Interesting way to look at it. And so after Texas, if I'm right, that's when you went to Bloomington, Indiana.
That's correct. Sue decided to get her PhD, and we came to Bloomington, Indiana, to Indiana University for her to pursue her studies.
Okay. Now, I'm sort of losing the timeline, because when we last talked, you were telling me about Portland and measure number 9, which you were very involved in.
Yes. Actually, Sue's going to love this that I'm talking so much about her. But Sue and I met at a Halloween party that was just 2 days before Oregon was to vote on measure 9. So if anybody has been paying attention to LGBTQ issues around the Pacific Northwest, are old enough to remember the 90s, Measure 9 was a law that was had come all the way to referendum. So it was a statewide referendum on the ballot that the state had to vote on, which would have restricted organizations, especially schools, from instructing or talking in any way, shape, or form about LGBTQ people. So there was a whole bunch of different ramifications that could have happened, but that was one of the main impacts. So it was a measure very similar to what's happened just recently in Florida. And then wonderful. Alabama and some of the other, Texas is attempting to do this as well, where the so-called don't say gay laws are being passed. Measure 9 was very much one of those things. So I was politically involved with trying to stop that measure from passing. And it was, you know, it feels very ironic now that, you know, we've been together now for over 30 years, and the same exact types of laws are still trying to get passed.
Wonderful.
That were there when we first met. So.
Okay, so you went to Indiana while she was getting her PhD, and what did you end up doing job-wise in Indiana?
I toggled together a whole bunch of different things for the first 3 or 4 years that we were there, including doing some arts and cultural journalism. So I was writing about kind of national issues from an arts or cultural perspective, and then, you know, calling up all of my contacts in these other places that I'd lived to give local color to an article that I could then publish in multiple alternative weeklies around the same thing. So I was doing a lot of that when we were first in Bloomington. And then I eventually got like a real arts job with a salary and all of that.
Nice.
And that was really, you know, I was in my late 20s at the time when I first got that first job. And so it took a long time.
And what was it?
So I was the program director for the Columbus Area Arts Council, mm-hmm. which is a small town about 45 minutes from Bloomington. So,
okay.
So the program director was a fantastic job. You got to pick all of the events that were going to happen and make them happen, but you didn't have to raise any of the money or
something to be said for that, you know,
or clean up after it. It was great. It was a wonderful job, but it was very much the first time I had done anything of that scale.
Okay. And you did that for a few years?
Did that for a few years. And then there was a historic theater in Bloomington, originally called the Indiana Theater, that while I was working in Columbus, a nonprofit organization in town was able to obtain the property and did a huge fundraising event or fundraising campaign, and was able to renovate the building to have live performance in it. It was an old movie palace. But unfortunately, they ran out of money while doing that. And so there was a couple years of high drama in town as we tried to figure out how to save the building that had just been renovated. And finally, a new nonprofit was formed, and I got hired to be the first executive director of this nonprofit whose complete mission was to run that theater on behalf of the city of Bloomington, which took over ownership of the property. And so I spent the next 18 years running that theater, and we did both live performance and film there.
And so what was the nonprofit called?
The nonprofit was called BCT Management, and it stood for Buskirk Chumley Theater, which was the name of the theater.
Okay. And so you were there for 18 years, you said?
I was there for 18 years.
And what were some of the things you did under the title of executive director? That can mean many things, right?
Yes. So, I mean, it really was very truly like I was the first and only employee when I was hired. I immediately hired E.J. Ernsberger, who was the first technical director. And for almost 5 years, it was primarily he and I running the place. So he would make sure everything worked on stage, and I did pretty much everything else. So it was very much a startup. But when I left, we had, I think there were 12 employees, like standard employees, and then we would have student staff members there as well. But one of the things I think that I did there that's the most relevant to my life here in Port Townsend is I founded a film festival called the Pride Film Festival. It was an LGBTQ film festival that ran for a weekend every year and was and only showed films in that one venue. But we had 600 seats to fill. So it was a real challenge to find the right kind of programming that would have that amount of appeal and really would bring together a community that was pretty intensely divided between people who lived full-time in the community and who often didn't have anything to do with the university, and then the university students. And just to give a sense of Bloomington, if you're not familiar with it at all, it's very much a small Midwestern college town. So 50,000 people out of 80 are students.
Wow.
And so you definitely had some town gown divide, mm-hmm. and just really big generational gaps between the age of the students and some of the long-term leaders mm-hmm. in LGBT rights in the community. And so to bring together everyone who wanted to celebrate LGBTQ in the community was a really big job, and the film festival was the first thing that really accomplished that in Bloomington.
Interesting. Well, it sounds like a pretty good job and fun and something you obviously cared about a lot. So why did you decide to leave? What prompted you?
So I had been there for really at the point where I had been there for 17 years. We were approaching the 100th anniversary of the theater. Mm-hmm. And we knew it was going to be another big energy push from the staff to leverage that 100th anniversary, to figure out how we moved into our next 100 years, what we wanted to do with the building, with the entity as a whole. And I felt at that time like I had pursued most of the strategies that I could come up with.
Okay, so the pandemic sort of interrupted your life. You weren't the only person there, but okay, so what did you decide to do next? I mean, obviously you ended up out here, but how did that happen from Bloomington, Indiana?
Yeah, so, you know, definitely things changed with our plans tremendously. I built a fence around our yard in Bloomington. I did a lot of gardening. Like I said, I got some really important rest and remove from the arts world for a little while there, which I highly recommend to anybody in leadership in the arts. It's good to take a break and sort of refresh yourself. If you can manage it, do it. And so after, about a year and a half, we were starting to think about all kinds of possible changes that we could make. I think that happened for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. That's
you had
for
rest
sure.
and reflection and started thinking about things.
What next?
But I wasn't very serious about looking for a job or doing, I hadn't made any real strong motions in that direction. But for years, I had had an alert on my LinkedIn page for any job announcements that came up in Port Townsend.
Oh, okay.
Because trying to, find an arts job in this small town.
Yes.
It's very few and far between that those came open. And I saw the announcement for the job at the film festival in the same week that my brother called and said that he and his girlfriend were going to move in together. And which meant that the house that he and I had inherited from our parents and that he had been living in was going to be available.
Uh-huh. That helps explain it.
And so we worked out a deal.
Yes.
And Sue and I had both a place to live and I had a job.
Wow.
And that was two things that we thought would never, ever happen
right
for us in Port Townsend. And she could work basically from anywhere. So
yeah, okay.
I said, let's pursue it and see if they would like to hire me.
Okay. So. And so officially, when did you start?
So I had 3 weeks of kind of orientation and overlap training with Jeanette Forrest, the previous director, in December of 2021.
Uh-huh.
And then I officially took over as the executive director on January 1st in 2022.
Okay. And just give us a brief recap of the film festival here. How old is it?
So we are going into this September will be our 24th year.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally founded by a group of people that included Rocky Friedman of the Rose Theater and a group of other people who were regular attendees at the Telluride Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they thought, why can't we have a Telluride here? And so they got it going. Peter Simpson joined forces with them very early on and was the executive director until his untimely death in 2008, I think. And Jeanette Forrest, who had been a real regular involved volunteer, stepped into the role of executive director.
Right. So we are coming up on the actual film festival for this year, 2023.
Mm-hmm.
And how is it looking right now in terms of attendance? Because if I'm right, you were dark in 2021 and sort of a little bit of attending in 22.
Jeanette and the staff were able to really to pivot really quickly and continue to offer film screening simply online.
Right.
So
right.
We were never completely dark. And
yeah.
In 2021 in September, there actually were two outdoor films that mm-hmm. were shown on Taylor Street.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very different from all of the hoopla of the years
before.
We've
got it coming now, right?
Mm-hmm. And so this year is very exciting. And the full program will be available on August 21st online. And people who have already purchased their passes or six ticket bundles will be able to begin selecting the films they want to attend. They can do that now in advance online starting August 21st.
Okay. And how many films do you have this year?
I believe there are 57 films.
Wow, that's a lot.
And we have roughly 30 films that have mentioned or have said that they are interested in sending filmmakers or other members of the team to the festival itself.
That's great.
And many of the listeners may have heard that we were able to partner with Centrum to present a concert by the Indigo Girls.
Right.
Monday the 25th, which will be our grand finale for the film festival. And we're doing so because Alexandria Baumbach, who is a long-term PTFF filmmaker, she was one of our first filmmakers in residence here in Port Townsend, made a documentary of the Indigo Girls that premiered at Sundance this year. So Alexandria brought that film to us. She'll be here as well.
Okay.
And then the subject of the documentary will be giving a concert.
That's great. Well, we're getting short on time here, but I think we should mention at least briefly the Women in Film Festival. That is not 24 years old. It's younger, right?
That is correct. Yes. Women in Film, which we did in person this year in April of 2023. I think that was the eighth year that it has happened. Of course, three of those years were online.
Yeah.
So we, tried some different things. We had forums as well as film screenings and a really incredible group of about a dozen female and non-binary identified filmmakers come through.
Getting close to when the festival actually begin. Are the early sales looking good? You're feeling good about everything?
Early sales are going really well. I do think that we're going to have a resurgence of attendance in person, and we haven't given up the online version as well. So if it's difficult for you in any way to get downtown and be there in person, or you can't cram in as many films in one weekend as you would like to watch, the virtual option will also still be there.
Okay. Well, that's great. And did the virtual option continue, or is that time limited?
It only runs for a week following the in-person festival.
Okay, so you can't say I'll watch it in October.
No.
Okay, all right. Just to be clear about that.
Yes.
Okay, 30 seconds. Any big plans for changes, or are you just happy to be getting back to full speed?
I'm really excited about the development of forums. They're now going to be happening inside of the weekend. So you'll be able to choose a film screening and then a film class. And I think that will be really intriguing to our burgeoning filmmakers around the community, and also for our very educated, very involved audience of film lovers to find out more about the craft of filmmaking.
Well, there's certainly a lot of film lovers in this town. So I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This is Mary Ann McNellis. You're listening to Our Town. My guest today has been Danielle McClellan, the Executive Director of the Port Townsend Film Festival. Port Townsend Film Festival is moving into a new era. The original founders have largely left and turned over reins to a new generation, and you're the new leader of that. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
In addition to thanking Danielle, I also want to thank Sunny Flores, editor and producer of Our Town. Many of you don't realize how important an editor is on a show like this. He will distill what we're saying so we sound very fine. He can edit out mumbles, ums, even you knows, making us sound so much more eloquent and smooth. All of us here at KPTZ get $0 for our work, and that includes Sunny and me. And that's because we're a community radio station by and for the people of Jefferson County. We don't get any government funding. We rely on you, the listener, for donations. So feel free to donate at any time. Many of you know this. We're soon going to be moving out of our wonderful world headquarters in a trailer at Mountain View School, and we're going to move to Fort Worden. It's being remodeled. It got sort of stuck with the pandemic, but soon we will be there. It will even be soundproof. It'll be wonderful. I want to thank you, the listener, for sticking with KPTZ. It's been a bumpy ride with that little pandemic going on. So listeners, stay healthy, safe, but be careful because the virus is still lurking out there. So keep your radio, if you're old style, tuned to KPTZ 91.9 FM. And if you're online, listen to us at kptz.org. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ. I'm Mary Ann McNellis, signing off for today. But please keep listening to KPTZ for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Mary Ann McNellis and edited by Sunny Flores.